This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading again from Eye of the Albatross by Carl Safina, but I have a special announcement. I'm excited that I'll be hosting a special program coming up on September 8th, that's a Monday, at 9:30 a.m. during the Valley Stewardship Network Program Conservation Connections. We will have a special guest, Dr. Stanley Temple. He is a senior fellow at the Aldo Leopold Foundation and Beers Bascom Professor Emeritus in Conservation at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and will be focusing on two related topics, Aldo Leopold and phenology. Phenology is studying, observing when natural events occur during the year, and doing that year after year to see how changes happen over time. And the recent transcription of Leopold's shack journals, where he recorded his phenological observations that inspire essays in a Sand County Almanac. And we'll talk about the Aldo Leopold Foundation's popular annual phenology calendar, which Dr. Temple authors. I'm going to put links on my Natural Wonders archives to the calendar and to the transcribed Leopold journals, so you can look at them now. I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that Stan Temple is known around the world for his long career studying birds in places as far-flung as the island of Mauritius to Alaska's Yukon River. He was mentored as a young boy by Rachel Carson, who saw that great potential in him, and he was a professor to hundreds and hundreds of students who many have gone on to great careers in wildlife studies. And I'm proud to have him coming to Viroqua to be a guest on WDRT on September 8th at 9:30. And check out my Natural Wonders archive for the links right now to the calendar and the transcribed shack journals of Aldo Leopold. And now I'll continue reading from Eye of the Albatross by Carl Safina, published in 2002. We are centered on Tern Island in the vast Pacific Ocean. If you haven't heard any of my previous readings from this book, you can find them archived at wdrt.org. We're following the travels of a Laysan albatross female who is foraging over the ocean to find food for her chick and food for herself. The food for herself is becoming more urgent as she's been feeding her chick about everything she can catch. She has a satellite transmitter that follows her movements and relays them back to Safina and others, and they marvel at what they see. I am starting on a chapter called Moving On. In these first four trips since her egg hatched, beneath her belly, Amelia has logged round-trip distances of 506, 199, 917, and 2,388 miles. The girl's just warming up. Amelia is a workaholic, though she's just returned from an eight-day trip of over 2,000 miles. She seems to think there are better things to do than to sit around brooding. After a short nest rest, just a few minutes, she walks slowly to the runway, turns into the southerly breeze, and cranks herself into the wind. Once airborne, she wheels and puts the wind behind her. It's a good start because this will be an even longer trip. In the last couple of weeks, Amelia has spent a lot of time foraging in the meager tropics. Her devotion shows her chick has grown vigorous and healthy, but she has put all her surplus energy into her chick, and she herself has been losing weight steadily while scouring thousands of miles of ocean slipping beneath her. Despite her hunger, the small size of her chick urges her to begin this trip as she began the last, looking for food nearby, trying not to stray too terribly far from Tern, searching the trackless, crystalline tropic sea. At sunset, the shining sea stretches away and around the world like a gold-threaded tablecloth. Her hunger briefly pulls her in the direction of reliable food she knows lies far north. She swings northward, but then swerves east into the night and then into the dawn. After flying 360 miles, Amelia is back in the concert hall, foraging among the musicians' seamounts. Without slowing perceptibly, she flies the length of the Chopin seamount, then swings up across the Haydn and skirts the handle, turning northwest. Measure by measure, mile after mile, she waltzes along. Though the sea is wide as ever and she is hundreds of miles from any land or visual marker, she travels along the seamount province as though able by magic to divine the lay of the seafloor miles below. She swings past Tchaikovsky, performs a 30-mile loop like a ballerina dancing Swan Lake on the world stage, and swoops back up to Debussy. Her grace and style are breathtaking, but she is repeating her last marginal trip. That trip worked well enough for the chick, but what worked well enough then does not work well enough now. It's a week later, a week further into her hunger, into her loss of weight and body condition. Her devotion to home wavers. Her blood chemistry is signaling her brain. The long averaging process of evolution steps in as though whispering, I am crucially hungry. No chick benefits from a mother starved to death. So the seesaw between maternity and hunger tips, and now hunger wins. Amelia has decided she will go for food, real food, much food. She'll ignore the sight of a few flying fish, and she'll ignore every faint cue the tropically warm ocean gives her about small snacks or some fish eggs here or there. She is no longer foraging. Now she is truly traveling, and she knows exactly where she's headed. She strikes north, directly north, absolutely north, straight as an arrow, north. She'll leave the boobies and frigate birds and terns far behind her. She is headed to the edge of cold water. She burns past Stravinsky Seamount like a firebird and hurries past Schubert as if she has unfinished business. For the first time in months, Amelia will fully unfurl. Like an Olympic runner just stepping onto the track, she will now be what an albatross is all about, traveling to the limits of any sea. No ocean stretches far enough to outdistance an albatross. They seem to bend the laws of physics. In this magic realm, space collapses and single birds command whole ocean basins, and time's arrow becomes elliptic, cyclic, as the birds become consumed with going and returning. On a favoring wind, Amelia sails nearly 600 miles in 30 hours. Much of that time, she flies in half sleep, on and on. Over the miles, the sea temperature begins dropping slowly. Eventually, Amelia reaches the southern edge of a broad frontal zone that blends warmer and colder water. 900 miles now from Tern Island. Amelia slows along this edge. The broad boundary she is working flows across the entire North Pacific in a slow but highly dynamic current that wavers like an unmanned fire hose. This fountain of change separates the warm-hearted Central Pacific from the chill subarctic. All things referenced as tropical now lie far behind her. Amelia hesitates, turning toward the northeast a ways, following a 100-mile meander in the flowing current. This front constitutes the northern border of the 600-mile-wide North Pacific Current, the current's broad northern and southern margins undulating across the ocean at roughly 30 degrees and 40 degrees north are known respectively as the subtropical and subarctic frontal zones. The wide North Pacific Current and its frontal borders separate higher salinity tropical southern water from the cooler and fresher subarctic water to the north. They separate two enormous regions of the North Pacific distinct biological realms inhabited by very different groups of animals. The tropical side is the sparsely populated solar realm of frigate birds, flying fish, and tunas. The cold side, near where Amelia is now, is the richer polar kingdom of fulmars, herring, and salmon. Two worlds. The North Pacific Current itself originates in the Western Pacific, spawned where the warm Kuroshio, dark blue current in Japanese, coming north along Japan's coast, collides with the cold Oyashio, mother current, flowing down from the Bering Sea. This tangled mass of enriched water then heads eastward as the North Pacific Current. Where the North Pacific Current crashes into North America, the portion deflected north becomes the Alaska Current, flowing up along British Columbia and then curling west along the Gulf of Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. The part turning southward becomes the California Current, a meandering jet of water flowing south, shedding eddies and cool filaments. It keeps the coastal ocean chilly all the way down past San Francisco. Near the equator, the water turns back westward, recrossing the Pacific Ocean, and when it hits Asia, the part of it that turns north along the coast becomes the Kuroshio all over again. The round trip takes about 5 years. In 6 days at sea, Amelia has flown from latitude 23 degrees north to 40 degrees. It's like traveling from southern Baja, Mexico, to the Oregon border, or from the Bahamas to central New Jersey. She is now foraging the border waters of the subarctic frontal zone. She is hunting intently, scrutinizing the greener water here. When the scent of a school of fish wafts to her, she flies a mile or so until the scent dissipates, then doubles back until it gets stronger, then passes it until it again grows faint. Once more, she wheels and doubles back until she's found the perimeter of the densest scent and has some sense of the school's direction of travel. Now she searches intently over the thickest aroma, flying mile-long patterns for a couple of hours, waiting for the light to weaken and the fish to rise. Packs of fish called souries, elegantly thin and about 6 to 8 inches long, come up into view. She lands near a dense group, and they scatter. She lifts off again, resuming her large oval flight patterns. Amelia finds one dying souri and then a dead squid. Glimpses of fishes in the closing dark are followed by squid rising under cover of the gathering dark. With eyes nearly as well adapted to the dark as an owl's, Amelia begins seeing more squid here and there as the sunset melts away to the shine of mid-ocean starlight. But she is still working hard and traveling many miles between mouthfuls. Hungering still, she breaks off her search. Again, she swings straight north, skimming over piling swells that roll like dark marching hills and white-capped seas whipped by blustery new winds that have come to oppose the current until another 180 miles of water separate her from Tern Island. Well over 1,000 miles from her chick, Amelia is now on the northern edge of that broad subarctic frontal zone bordering the cold water. Amelia zigs and zags this boundary. The weather isn't so nice, but to Amelia the chilly air feels refreshing, brisk, bracing. The water slipping beneath her now is plain cold, as low as 54 degrees Fahrenheit. The single-celled drifting planktonic plants at the bottom rung of the sea's larder like it cool, so this cooler water is greener, cloudier, with plankton. It has lost its tropical clarity. With that lost clarity and the new chill, the water has also lost its tuna, and with the tuna have gone the tuna-dependent tropical seabirds, the boobies, tropical terns, and frigates. Those birds are much better than Amelia at making a living among the ballistic beasts of the tropic seas, but they can't make a living out here at all. This is the advantage of albatrosses, to make a modest living, yet be able to do so over most of the ocean. Lazen albatrosses can feel at home anywhere in all this vast realm, and that's why there are so many of them. The subarctic in early March isn't exactly the same sunny, warm climate that Amelia left at her nest. It is gales and sleet, freezing and dark and terrible. Few marine animals can withstand both extremes, but albatrosses do. How does she handle that kind of climate shift? Dave Anderson, looking at the satellite track Amelia is sending to his lab, has this answer. I don't know. I don't have any idea how an albatross can do that. Most animals would freak out. This bird, in a few days, went from basically a tropical climate to basically an Arctic climate. I don't know how it can handle such abrupt change. When I first saw what this bird is doing, it was quite a moment. Unquote. Albatrosses belong in cold waters like these, along these fronts and gradients, in this chilly air, where the wind seems to have an appetite of its own. Here in the chill, Amelia feels fully at home and comfortable for the first time since she went to Tern Island months ago to start the breeding season. Amelia works this zone 4 days, sometimes in the flowing front, then drifting beyond, then back along the front. She searches for concentrated scents, sharp sea color changes, and other signs of concentrated life. She moves west into the current for 225 miles one day, 250 the next. Then she finds the life she's looking for and the death that accompanies it. The frontal boundary is distinct here. The sea surface temperature gradient sharp. Certain patches along this front suddenly seem almost to be squirting with squid. This is part of the area, in fact, where during the 1980s and into the 90s, the squid boats of Taiwan, Japan, Korea set tens of thousands of miles of drift nets each night. Pacific albatrosses had been recovering from the feather hunting of the early 1900s and the disruption of World War II and Cold War military presences at major breeding sites when drift nets began infesting their foraging areas. With something like 40,000 miles of nylon webbing spun into the blue Pacific each night, hungry albatrosses found a lot of dead fish and squid tangles in those nets, but the drift nets served dangerous dinners before the United Nations finally banned them in the early 1990s. They'd originally promoted the same nets. Each year, roughly 22,000 Hawaiian albatrosses attempting to wine and dine got wound and drowned. Their populations again declined. Drift net crews sometimes fashioned earrings from albatross leg bands. Those nets also killed much larger numbers of other seabirds. The estimated kill of sooty shearwaters ran to 500,000 annually for over a decade. Tens of thousands of dolphins, whales, and seals also drowned, and tens of millions of unwanted fish died in the nets and were shoveled overboard. The level of collateral mortality doesn't begin to speak to the millions and millions of tunas, marlins, swordfish, salmon, and neon flying squid that the nets removed from the oceans. Amelia is now a recipient of the United Nations' belated wisdom and the banned boat's departure. Not only did so many albatrosses die annually in those nets, but now more squid again slide through the waters here for Amelia and for the famished feathered nations whose culinary traditions were set long before the seas were etched by a million wakes. Amelia is also benefiting from the predations of pods of dolphins. From time to time, they stage well-coordinated attacks, streaming up under the squid from below in tight, streaking packs, sending them fleeing into the atmosphere. Packs of squid are jetting around here and there, appearing and disappearing everywhere and nowhere. Stimulated by the activity, aware of the opportunities, keenly alert, Amelia wheels in among the streaking mammals and swift fleets of fleeing squid. She lands and takes off repeatedly, trying to keep up with the speeding dolphins. She splashes in among their bubble trails and deep boils and the spraying squid, paddling around excitedly, sometimes clumsily, trying to exploit the possibilities that keep coming and going around her. Her snapping bill mostly misses, registering a loud empty clack. But once there's the satisfying feel and heft of writhing flesh impaled with the nail of her bill tip. The squid wraps its resisting arms around her bill and she shakes and worries the life from it. It goes coolly into her belly and for a while it squirms a little as it warms. She likes the feeling of food inside. But the main thing for Amelia is that the squid are here spawning. And after they spawn, they die. And after they die, many float to the surface, and beautiful, fresh, floating squid are what makes this trek north worth all the effort. She begins loading up on nice, ice-cold squid. She's finally putting back a little weight and storing extra food. Here in the rich, cold water, Amelia has company. Many other Laysan albatrosses, a few black-footed albatrosses, most of them are much farther east, nearer the continental coast, and very occasionally a rare short-tailed albatross from Japan. Amelia doesn't pay much attention to any of them, except when they're zooming in on the same meal. And I'll stop there. Nice to know that she's getting some good food. I also wanted to mention that there are some terrific videos online of albatrosses slope soaring and beautiful images of them making their way over the ocean. And also, Cornell has some video of albatross, so you could look at Cornell albatross videos. That would be good search words. And then there's hashtag Royal Cam highlights of the Royal Albatross down in New Zealand, the breeding area, and the work they're doing, picking up the chicks, these beautiful, massive, huge chicks, and weighing them and doing their good work trying to increase their numbers down in the southern hemisphere, taking care of them, banding them. It's really neat. I love it. It's starting to show up a lot on my YouTube videos. So if you love albatrosses, these videos are a lot of fun to watch. Don't forget, next September 8th, 9:30 in the morning, Monday, we'll be interviewing Stan Temple on WDRT. 91.9 on your dial. Thank you, WDRT, for everything you do. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.